This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Carm Capriotto, Remarkable Results Radio. Wow. 9 years going. Thank you so much for your support to everyone who listens and shares, does the YouTube with us, Spotify, Apple, all that great stuff. We just have so much fun doing this. We're constantly looking for new topics, ways to actually stretch our thinking. We are kind of in a mature industry, but it's not. It's constantly evolving. A lot of new and young people coming in. You know, our shortage of our great technology specialists, our mechanical specialists are there. And I've never worked so hard. Just recently been out to a automotive cooperative school where they have all kinds of skilled trades in, and we can't wait to talk about it here in the future. But before we get going, listen, we all know someone who's been affected by breast cancer in some form or fashion, personally or through, you know, your friend network. And did you know that our aftermarket service repair industry has an initiative started by two shop owners? It's Breaks for Breasts, which has so far raised $1.8 million for a vaccine for triple negative breast cancer. 100% of every penny donated goes right to the research at the Cleveland Clinic. We need your help. As always, October is Breaks for Breast Month, and we'd love you to get involved. As the vaccines in clinical trials, please go to breaksforbreasts.com and roll your shop in this cause, or just say, hey, I don't care about October. I'm going to do something each and every month and send a boatload of money up to Breaks for Breasts each and every year. Napa Auto Care Centers are recognized as an integral piece to what sets Napa apart from the competition. And the Napa Auto Care brand? Well, it continues to be fully integrated into the national marketing strategy by optimizing targeted media in local markets and in proven channels. Don't forget, Napa Auto Care Centers have an online presence on Napa Online with the Auto Care Locator tool, generating millions of views per month. If you're interested in partnering with Napa Auto Care and capitalizing on America's largest network of parts and care, talk to your Napa Auto Parts sales rep today. Tanner Brandt is here. Hey, Tanner.
How are you today?
I'm great. President of the Auto Diet Clinic. Trainer for what? For CTI? ST? Worldpac?
Nope. Just myself now.
Just yourself now?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, what I know about you and your business and your knowledge, you are probably super busy.
Yeah, very busy. Busy with every aspect of it, I would say. Busy with the mobile programming diagnostic side, and then also really busy with the consulting side. So can't complain. Happy that it's worked out, but definitely stressful at times.
Tanner lived up here in New York State for a lot of years, and then he, I don't know, was it the snow or a job? Well, what happened? What got you out of here?
Just cold weather.
Oh, geez. All right. And there's a lot of people that do love it and stay here. But anyway, he just recently built a beautiful home. And God, one day I just love to see it. I got to Tanner and I said, look, you're a trainer. We do a lot of stuff on, we bring trainers on. We talk about training all the time. I said to him, would it be cool to do an episode on how to learn? We all want to make a commitment to lunch and learns and leader leds and go to conferences. But I've always felt, and it took me a lot of years to realize what I had to do in order to get my money's worth and to literally take something back and then do something with it and not just say, check the box, I went to a conference. And if I'm lucky, in 30 days, I may remember one thing.
Sometimes it's the one thing that you're trying to take away, though.
And so, it could be. Oh, yeah. That's the theme of my podcast, right? Listen to learn just one thing, right? Which isn't a bad thing, really.
Correct.
I said, Tanner, is there a methodology, you know, the what, the why, the how of learning and education? So the platform is yours, my friend.
I think everybody is looking to get as much knowledge as they can in as short of a amount of time as possible. We look at like language learning and stuff, and everyone's like, learn a new language in like 2 weeks or whatever. I personally can't do that. Maybe some people can, but it seems to be just part of the human race. We want to learn things as quickly as possible. In order to do that, I like to look at it in a couple different ways. I had sent Carm some talking points, and the first one is what, why, and how. I think Simon Sinek is the one that's actually credited with this, mm-hmm. and it looks like it was, he came up with it in 2014. Nothing against him. I love his book, and I think he's phenomenal, but I kind of think this was a thing prior to that. It's something that gets used a lot in business planning and has for like many, many years. Obviously, again, not to take any credit away from him, but most business planning always looked at, you know, what were you trying to accomplish? Why were you going to do it? And then how were you going to accomplish it? So with learning, I look at it the same way. What is it that you're trying to learn? Why do you want to learn it? And then how are you going to accomplish it? The first thing is that we have to make a plan and say, okay, this is what I believe I need to know. So sometimes we misdiagnose vehicles. I'm very guilty of this. That's pretty much all I do all day is diagnose vehicles. So every year there's vehicles that I misdiagnose and I keep a list of those. And then I go, this is what I struggled with. This is why I struggled with it. And then what can I do to fix it, or how am I going to fix it? Each year when I'm going to conferences, I start kind of planning out those conferences of where can I go and, you know, who has a class that I can take that's going to help me fix what I screwed up basically and learn that. That's the first steps to build the plan out. So once you build the plan out, then you've also got to start to think through the why of everything.
Here, I'm a technology specialist. I'm working on a vehicle and I'm stumped. Shouldn't my intuition and common sense go over on this piece of paper and write down, I think I didn't know this really well, so this is something I got to learn. And I'm not saying I didn't screw it up, I didn't have a comeback, but I stumbled with it a little longer than I expected, so I got to get in deeper. Is that part of the what or the why?
Yeah, definitely. So I think it's important to take notes. I know that you're a big note taker, and I am too. Most of the time when I'm diagnosing a vehicle, I just have a scribble sheet and I'm scribbling down all of my like thoughts, more or less, and my thoughts of the process. This is the problem with the vehicle. These are the possible scenarios. And then I go through those possible scenarios. You write down your process and now all of a sudden you've got stumped somewhere along the way. Maybe one of those scenarios you didn't know how to test. So at that point, you're looking at it and saying, okay, why was I stuck there? The why portion, in my opinion, is also really, really important. This is something I hopefully will eventually do a keynote on. I keep saying I'm going to like go real deep into this and the thought process. But the why for me, I look at is you always have to be thinking of why you are performing steps, whether you're diagnosing a vehicle or you're just simply working on a vehicle. There's a story that I tell. I had a technician that was doing a timing belt on a car. And I got called out there three different times for the same vehicle. Each time the vehicle was put together out of time. So the third time I stayed at the shop with the technician and I made them take the car all apart. And this was just last year. So this is while I had this business. And I had the technician take the car all the way apart. We started right from scratch, first step of the procedure, putting this timing belt back on. What I discovered is he was performing the steps in service information, but he didn't understand why he was performing the steps. So one of the steps that he got to, there's a tool. This was a Ford, like 2 liter or something, or 1.5. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, one of the steps, there's a tool that bolts on to the harmonic balancer at the very end, and the crank reluctor's on the balancer. And that tool has to go into the back of it, and it has a nub on it, and that goes through a hole in the balancer. That tool gets bolted on and holds the balancer in a specific place. But in the pictures and the description, that's not really explained. It just tells you to bolt this tool on. So he would bolt the tool on and then just stick the balancer on and didn't understand that step. So the way I explained it to him is every single tool that you're installing in this, as you're going through this, you need to understand why that tool is being used. That wasn't just getting bolted on just to get bolted on. There was a why that you needed to know.
I'm a shortcutter, by the way. Just give me a grill to go put together and, oh, this is easy. This goes here. And all of a sudden, I miss a step and I have to go back. And it took me a half hour and I should have stayed in line. And I love, to your point, why are they telling me to do this next? I love this.
Exactly. So the why is always very important. You have to, I tell people you should, outside of automotive, for this is the part of the keynote that I am like passionate about that I'd like to do, is you should always be deliberate in your actions and know why you are doing something. So one of the ones I tell all my shops, and everyone's going to laugh at me for this, and everyone's going to go, this guy's OCD, and I'm sure I'm a little bit OCD. I'm positive I am. Everyone is. But I always joke about when you get older, everything gets harder, myself included. So if you put jeans on, and your jeans are tighter, the women will probably understand this more. Your jeans are tighter, and then you're trying to put your socks on. It's kind of hard to bend down. So it's easier to put your socks on first than it is to put your jeans on first, because it makes it easier to bend down. So you do things, you know, funny things like this, but you go, oh, that does make sense. It would be a lot easier to put my socks on first. So things like that through life, and then that relates into there's a book about habits, and I read that book and kind of thought to myself, this is interesting. Most of this I do. I guess I should have just written a book. I just thought it was me being strange, I guess. But forming, doing things that you need to do to make your life easier. If that's you want to make coffee in the morning and you set up the coffee machine at night, you deliberately do things, but you have to know why you're deliberately doing them. Just, you know, if you're restoring a house and you tear apart every single room in the house while you're trying to live there, now all of a sudden it's a problem and you don't know why you tore apart every room in the house. You didn't have a plan. So deliberately doing things, knowing why you are deliberately doing them, and then doing them in a certain order to make your life easier. That's one of the big things that I push when I'm trying to train somebody. And again, that could be in automotive, or that could be a young person, me just trying to get them to think through school.
Tanner, do you have to have a logical mind to ask the why questions?
I don't think you necessarily have to have a logical mind. However, I'm going to jump to one of my other points on this. I think that we kind of cause problems with this in school, in education, and with sometimes just upbringing of, you know, young people in general. Everyone that has kids knows that you get the stage of when they ask why. Everything they want to ask why, and eventually the parents get annoyed and they're just, because. However, that's the stage in their life when they're trying to learn the why. Well, then we yell at them and we tell them to stop asking why. Every parent does this, every school does this, and they don't realize that by doing that, eventually then that kid stops asking why.
Why becomes irrelevant.
Exactly. And then when we get later on in life in education, as we're trying to learn things, New York State, this was something, obviously we know we had Regents exams. Most of the teachers, I can't, I always think when I tell this story of like how angry I made a lot of my teachers and they didn't understand why. But I was always asking questions about why are we doing this? Where am I going to use this? And specifically one time I singled out a math teacher and we were learning trig and I could not relate it to anything and I didn't understand what we were trying to do. It made no sense to me. And she's like, stop asking questions. This is just the way it is. Just write down the formula and do it. Well, she didn't know the why. She didn't have an understanding of like how it was actually used. So it made it hard for me to relate that to real world to have an understanding of it. In education, when you're teaching to like Regents exams or something, a lot of that ends up being forgotten. The test has been written for many, many years. And although good intentions on their part of writing the test, all of a sudden, as a test exists for many years, now instead of the test being written on the curriculum gets written on the test. And then the teachers don't understand the why, and we're just memorizing formulas and answers. So as we go, the logical mind goes away with students and young people.
So you're in front of a class and you're doing some training. I can, and I've actually observed you, but I've never just taken an entire class. You are probably up there saying there's no bad questions. We got to know the whys behind this stuff. And you probably encourage people just based on your training style to want to know the why, to follow the steps. So I would imagine that not only are you out there, say, teaching a GDI class or whatever it is, you're giving your students even a deeper sense of learning.
Yeah. So specifically with the last like long class, I would say that I developed would be the turbocharger class. And I tell everybody right at the beginning of class, ask as many questions as you want. There is no stupid question. Don't feel, you know, funny as you're asking questions. And then I purposely wrote that class with the physics side of it. So we do the mechanical portion, we do the diagnostic portion, but then we talk about airflow and how airflow is affected, how restrictions cause problems and things like that. And I break that all down and show them so that they understand the why. With turbochargers, a lot of times you'll have oil leaks and people think that it's a seal inside the turbo. There isn't seals inside it. Long story short, it's a restriction that creates a vacuum. So I go through that so that we understand the why and not just say, well, you can get oil in it, but it's not caused by it and move on. That's how a lot of classes are, because they don't understand the last part of it, the why. So I'm very big on students always asking questions, thinking through things. I really like, if you've ever sat through a John Thornton class, John is really good about if a student has a question, answering the question, backing up to make sure that they can get the answer. Even if he has to go back 10 pages and start, you know, a whole case study over, he'll do it to make sure the student gets the understanding of why he took the steps he did, you know, how he came to the conclusion at the end of the case study. He's really good about that. Even sometimes I'm helping with right now writing another class for another company, but we're going through with the curriculum developer. And sometimes it's funny because everybody thinks differently, right? So I have to explain something and then back up and re-explain something to the curriculum developer. And we go back and forth until he gets it. Sometimes that gets explained 10 times, 10 different ways, but he'll eventually understand it. People need to understand that it is okay to work through things in that aspect. However, again, when we went through school, that's something that typically they get really upset about. So it gets crushed out of you as you're, you know, younger.
There's a great word that gets crushed out of you. Oof. If I am a curious person, am I a better technology specialist, diagnostician?
I think so, definitely. I mean, the amount of time that Matt and I spend, me, Matt, Justin, others, but the three of us, I would say, like, the amount of time somebody has sent a text message and did you see this? And it's an SAE paper, or, you know, some random thing that we've been looking up at Vision. There was some stuff that came up during a class and we went right to Matt's scope class. One of the students asked and said, you know, how do you think this works? Does it actually work? Like, I don't know, let's give it a shot. So Matt and I sat there with him and went through all the scope procedures that were in the class to try to figure it out. And so I would definitely say curiosity didn't kill the cat in this scenario. Curiosity is a very, very good thing. And something that should be nurtured, I would say, from a young age instead of getting annoyed. But I see a lot of times that, you know, very few teachers, I would say, unfortunately, especially if that's class sizes are large, very few teachers nurture that. And that's, in my opinion, how it kind of goes away. It starts going away at a young age. And by the time they're in high school, a lot of times they're just, you know, going through the motions. If you're somebody that's curious and you know you're not getting that help, I would say, whether you're already out in the automotive field or you're still in school, you know, try to find teachers or mentors that are willing to help you with that and work through that stuff with you.
I'm a curious person because I love to go on plant tours. And I'll never forget, we have a Ford stamping plant here that knocks out, you know, panels for vehicles. And just to go through this, it took an hour to go through with this group of people. And I was like, I could never catch up to the group because I was always standing back watching, boom, watching a big mold come down and crank something out. And I'm asking, how does this happen? I'm just so darn curious. I've had a chance to watch a few episodes of Grey's Anatomy. It's all about surgeons. And I was looking at watching someone, you know, it's all, of course, fictitious. But, and again, I don't know if they're representing the surgeon correctly. I don't. But when they jump in and they're analyzing stuff, they not only have to know their craft, right? But they have to know everything else about that vehicle, how the body, how everything connects. And they actually have to be curious because if they do this, what happens over here? Maybe part of our training or our our goal of the success that we're at is you're a vehicle surgeon, you're a diagnostic surgeon. Well, I never thought that through. Interesting.
Yeah. And so I have a friend back home that's a bone surgeon, and he has a room in his house to review x-rays. And each night prior to the surgery, and probably more than just the night prior, but he would always go through all the x-rays and look at it and make a plan of going, okay, we're going to have to do this. We have to be aware of that the bone's broken in, you know, this way. The only time that he basically was thrown into it blind was if it was some type of emergency situation and he didn't get to look at it. But anybody that was had a planned surgery, he would take all the x-rays home, put them up on his thing, study it, and build the plan all out for how the surgery was going to go.
A reality of doing business today is facing a technician shortage, and Napa Auto Care is a free solution with the Napa Auto Care Apprentice Program. The program was pioneered by one of our own, Pete McNeil, and master technician Jake Sorensen from McNeil's Auto Care in Sandy, Utah, and they realized that the problem of not having technicians available for hire was not going to solve itself and decided to take action. A focus was put on younger individuals with the right passion, desire, aptitude, and attitude to work in the automotive repair industry. Jake and Pete sought after these individuals and developed a technician apprentice program to give them the training needed to become a successful technician in today's world. The Napa Auto Care Apprentice Program includes a comprehensive 9-stage curriculum that includes a variety of types of training, including exclusive in-depth classroom training videos, instructor-led Napa Auto Tech classes, web-based Auto Tech e-learning courses, and practice skills with hands-on learning in the shop with the guidance of a mentor. The Apprentice Program curriculum is competency-based, meaning an apprentice can move through each stage at a pace that best suits them. Most apprentices complete the program within 2 years, and upon completion, apprentices will have earned 4 ASE certifications, G1, A4, A5, and AC certifications, adding industry validation to the skills an apprentice acquires. Apprentice graduates are also registered with the Department of Labor as Journey Worker Automotive Technicians. Having an apprentice in your shop will ultimately benefit your shop as they advance through the program. In most cases, as the apprentice develops their skill set producing billable hours, you'll see a growth in your gross profit by stage 5. One of the largest entry barriers for individuals looking to enter the automotive repair industry is the cost of tools. To keep your apprentice motivated, they receive an apprentice toolkit, including a 4-drawer tool cart for all registered apprentices. Together, Napa Auto Care and your shop can fix the technician shortage. Start now, grow your own, and build your bench. Our future technicians can come from our concentrated efforts, and it's free. Contact your Napa representative to learn more or log in to member.napaautocare.com or contact your servicing Napa Auto Parts store's sales representative. Tanner's dropping names like Matt and Justin. It's Matt Fonslow, Justin Morgan, and all of your other friends in the industry. You're all tight about that. And I swear, one time Matt said to me, I'll think about the job I have to do tomorrow. You know, someone sent me in a diag problem. And what do I know? What do I remember? What have I ever studied? Whatever notes have I written? And it's like you're dreaming on it overnight. You're mentally preparing.
Yeah. That's definitely. John Rogers is really good about that too. He's one that always at night, unfortunately, sometimes at night, the various OEM softwares, that's when they do maintenance. So I'll get a message from him of that, you know, whatever software is down. I'm like, it's 9 o'clock at night. Why are you on? But he's on researching something for the following day. We all try to be out or in and out of a shop as, you know, quickly as we can when we're mobile, because the faster we get out of the shop, the more we can fit in. So having a game plan when we get there is definitely a big thing. And even if you're not mobile, you're just in a shop, having an idea of the system knowledge, that would be a big one. And that's what I would say most of us are researching is, how does this system work? If it's something that we haven't seen before, I had yesterday a newer Honda, new TPMS system, or newer, I should say. It's indirect, like an old system, so it doesn't use TPMS sensors. But it uses wheel size, steering angle torque, a whole bunch of different things in the ABS system and VSC, not to get like real deep into it. There's an article out there about it, and I think it's in P10. At any rate, I wrote it a couple of years ago. And so this system looks at a plethora of different things, and I had written this article, so I knew how it works. When I got there yesterday, they were struggling with it, and I looked at it, and it had codes for the TPMS system, but they couldn't get the steering angle to relearn. And I had explained to them, well, the steering angle won't relearn until the TPMS codes are gone, because the steering angle is part of the TPMS system in this case. So those TPMS, the system had to be recalibrated, which was go drive it. Then they could do the steering angle learn, but it wouldn't do it without having the TPMS system corrected because it thinks it has the wrong size tires on it.
So the best question that I have for you is why?
Yeah, exactly.
Why would Honda do this?
Honda came up with it basically to... They were trying to get rid of TPMS sensors, but it has to do with electronic steering because it had to do with steering torque. So I suspect the main reason behind it was so that it had a better idea of how much torque to put on the steering wheel with driver assistance systems. That was probably a large portion of it.
If the tire was underinflated, is an example?
Yep, exactly.
Or even over.
Yeah, correct. Yep.
And so here's the engineers in Detroit doing all this really cool stuff, and you have to figure it out.
And I think, too, with, like, again, with the why of sometimes these systems that end up on, say, a Honda or a GM, the people at Honda, GM, Ford, whatever, also might not understand, like, why the system does what it does because they didn't design the system. It could have came from Bosch or Siemens or Continental or whoever. And those are the people that have the understanding of why they're doing something and, you know, why the logic is written in the way it is. So sometimes, too, with engineering at a OEM car company, you'll call and get in touch with them and go, you know, why does this work this way? And they're like, and then you reach out to the, you go, okay, well, there's a sticker on it from Continental or ZF or whoever. And all right, well, we'll call them. And then you'll get to the bottom of why it does what it does. And sometimes, too, it was engineered for one vehicle and got put in a different vehicle. So their reasoning behind why it does what it is supposed to do may not make sense for the vehicle that it's in, but it got used in it. So it's definitely interesting once you start going down that rabbit hole.
How important is focus? You walk up to the vehicle and knowing the exact problem you're looking to solve. Is that critical?
I think it's a good idea to at least have an idea of what's wrong and make your notes on it. I'm really big on, in my invoicing system, I use Shopware, and I have canned jobs for like specific things set up. So I have a no crank, no start canned job, and I check the same things on every single vehicle. And then I have a cranking, no start, and I check the same thing in the same order. Single cylinder, misfire, you know, very same thing. I check in the same order. So I think it's a good idea to have an idea of your problem. However, there's definitely enough problems and enough things on vehicles that there's certainly going to be problems where you've never seen it before and everything is kind of out the window as far as like you get a call about a driver assistance system problem tomorrow. And the following day, you could get a call about that a dome light doesn't work. And then it's kind of difficult to, you know, create a plan around that. But at least getting an idea of, okay, this is the problem I have. What systems are involved? What's controlling it? Like, for example, if it's an interior light problem, looking at all the diagrams for the interior lights, what do I need to know about it? What modules are working? Is there fuses for that specific light? Something like that. Where would codes be stored? What am I going to do? I'm real big on, I tell people, regardless of the vehicle, always do a complete system scan because that at least gives you an idea. Is there code stored somewhere that you wouldn't necessarily think to look? I had a shop literally just 2 days ago that had a no crank, no start vehicle in, and it had a key problem. But they didn't know it had a key problem because they only looked in the engine control module. There wasn't any codes there. It was also in the body control module. The body control module also is a theft module on that vehicle. So had they done a complete system scan, they would have saw that code and knew where their issue was. But without getting themselves the entire picture, then it makes it difficult to make diagnostic choices. So definitely making notes on it, figuring out your problem, putting a plan together, making sure that you understand the entire system is definitely important.
there's just so much there to unpack as a mobile dyad guy. And you don't get called on demand. You book like tomorrow and they tell you what the issue is so that you can prepare, maybe study, maybe look up some notes. But when you walk in, it hurts here, doc. Okay. You've got kind of an idea.
Yep, definitely. And there's certainly times, too, that we go in and that's completely out the window. There's times that, you know, people tell you what's wrong with a car, what they think is wrong with a car, and you get there and that car that they were talking to you about may not even be the vehicle that's actually there. That happens once in a while of they thought it was a Dodge whatever and it's a Chevy and then it's completely out the window, which drives me insane when it happens. But it does happen from time to time. But then you start the process over. You get there and go, okay, different vehicle, look it all up again. And the only part that sucks for them is if I have to look it all up while I'm there, it's just going to cost them more.
Let me go back to the how to learn. I'm in a classroom. I've got hopefully still a manual in front of me. With some great advice coming from you, get your pen out and in the margins, write the whys that you've been learning?
Yeah, definitely. If you're taking a class, when I'm going over a specific thing of, let's say, like network issues, understanding why the network is all tied together, understanding why one circuit being affected on a network affects the entire network. So definitely always looking for the why and always thinking through whether you're taking a class or you're working on a vehicle, just making sure that you always know the why in everything that you're doing. Why am I taking this step? Why is it directing me here? Dash jobs are a big one. If you go look up service information first, many times that will save you so much headache. There's a certain year Camaros that had two bolts that went down from the top and you have to take the windshield out. If you didn't read service information, you wouldn't understand why the windshield has to come out. But if you read service information, not only do you now know ahead of time that the windshield has to come out, but you understand why the windshield has to come out. So if you're just kind of guessing and you've heard that maybe the windshield has to come out, you don't know why, you don't know what step you're going to get stuck at. You're hoping you can shortcut it, but there is no way to shortcut it. So things like that, you should always look up procedures and then ask yourself why you're doing each step as you're looking through the procedure.
Okay, I'm in the bays. Where do I find expert help? I mean, I know there's all kinds of great forums, but how do I know what to pay attention to?
That's a really, really good question. So finding actual experts, I would say the best thing that you can do in this scenario is go around and talk to as many people as possible in your friend group. Matt and I always talk about, when you're at a conference, you can tell the people who are actual experts. I never want to take away from anybody that's doing training, but guys that are still in the bays are still working either in a shop or own a mobile diagnostic business, they're still doing it every day. So they're the ones that you're going to be able to ask, the why, I would say, a lot more versus somebody that is teaching a class and might not know the reason that the case studies came out the way they did, might not know the reason why something was written in a book because they're not the one that wrote it. If you can find the curriculum developer, a lot of times that helps too. Also trying to avoid watching like videos from people like Scotty Kilmer, unfortunately. Scotty was, I would say, an expert at one point in his time. If you go like way, way, way back in his content, he used to be a scope user and had some stuff about that. And at some point, he took a turn and just decided to scream at people on YouTube. Some people look at him as an expert. But then when you look at other people like Paul Danner, Eric O with South Main Auto, Mario, like any of those guys that are actually still working on stuff and have an understanding and want to make things better, those are the guys I look at as experts versus, the people on YouTube that are just there to get views. So sometimes it's hard to tell, I would say, of who's an expert. Even like, man, you read a magazine, or I think about reading magazines more back in the day, you would hope that who they were finding were experts. However, obviously sometimes money gets involved and that person may not be an expert. Going to conferences helps with that because you see the people that classes are well attended, talking to other people at the conference and kind of getting an idea of who they look up to, who they feel is an actual, you know, knowledgeable person. That's the best advice I guess I can give, is just asking others and trying to form some kind of opinion of who's, you know, worth listening to and who's not.
Let me ask you a question about accountability. I sign up for a networking class for Tanner Brand, and I go into this class. It's, let's just pick a number, 3-hour class. You set it all up. You encourage him to ask questions. There's no stupid question. And then you say this, listen, I really want you to walk away with a ton of stuff. So there's going to be a test at the end. And I don't know if you're doing it or not, but can you get more people to pay attention? And then can you have a better instructor knowing that they want this class to pass with a, you know, with an 80% or higher, or at least you have an open book and you go over the questions? Let's talk about that.
When you want to become an ATMC approved training company, that's a big thing with them, is pre-test and post-test. And I don't necessarily have a problem with post-test, I guess I would say, making sure that they got something out of it. So you're checking the knowledge. I'm good with that. However, if it's more than like 10 questions and it takes them more than 5 or 10 minutes to go over, if it takes them 20 minutes to go over it, I can cover a lot of material in 20 minutes and the time would have been better off spent going over class material. Totally good with a post test, so long as the test was written after the curriculum and not the test written prior to the curriculum. My big thing is that any test written should go, okay, what was taught, and then what should they know from that? Because I feel like when a test is written ahead of time and then curriculum is written, then you end up writing curriculum to a test, which may not be correct. And unfortunately, I would say that tests in general typically end up getting reused. So when we look at like education as a whole, the idea of the test may have started out really, really good and said, okay, what should they know? And we're going to write this test on that and then form the curriculum. But if that test doesn't change over years, now all of a sudden the curriculum keeps staying just to this test, and the people that are teaching that curriculum change year after year, but the curriculum stays the same. Now they may not understand why they're teaching what they are. So totally good with post-tests after a class, making sure that people got something out of it. I'm also big on just trying to make sure that the instructor is good. This is something that ATMC asked me, is how do we know that the person teaching the class is an actual expert? And my response was, well, you're unfortunately certifying the training companies, not the trainer. So the training company may get certified and the person that went through it may be an expert, but then the person teaching the class later on may not be an expert. And they may still be able to answer the questions at the end of the training because the answer to the questions are in their book, but they may not have taken something away from it. So I'm big on, if it comes down to a test at the end or a better instructor, I would rather have the better instructor than the test.
How do we certify trainers?
Even better question. So unfortunately, right now, I think the correct answer to that is having some type of continued education. So I look at like the medical field, for example. When you're going through college in the medical field, you're working the entire time. So you're getting practical knowledge. And then when you get out, you have to take a test. And then when you are in the field working, you have continued education every single year. I will always support everybody at ASE. We both have a lot of friends there. However, I have to look at it and go, there currently is no continued ed part of it. There is for some of the high school instructors, but there's also a big issue there that I don't know if I should get into, but the issue with continued ed right now is that nobody's overseeing the classes being taken, which then goes back to how do we make sure the instructor or the class they're taking is good. I personally feel that if the hours are enough, that they're going to take enough classes that even if they take one simple thing.
What kind of classes? I mean, are we talking about teaching skills, communication skills? Are we just looking to certify that the area that they're teaching and they really know all of the above?
I would say all of the above. So because I look at it as your motto, you know, learn just one thing. So if you're going to take a curriculum development class, then you're going to learn and take something away from that. If you're going to take a scope class, you're going to take something away from that. I've sat in so many classes, you know, hundreds of hours a year. There's certainly classes that I've sat in that I'm like, this, you know, was pretty outdated. Yeah. However, as long as you take something from it, eventually you just sit through enough hours that you go, okay, if I've learned one thing from every single class, now I've got this great knowledge base.
I got to stop you for a moment. This week I had my annual physical, and I've been going to this general practitioner for, maybe 25 years. So we know each other. I walk in, he goes, how's the podcast? Okay. That's kind of the relationship we have. And I said to him, do you have continuing education? And to your point, he said, yes. And I said, how do you justify it? He goes, I am currently right now taking my recertification test, and I have to do this every year so I can stay up to speed. And then I asked the tough question. I says, what if you don't pass and you don't get certified? Can you still practice medicine? And his answer was, yes, I can. And I said, so I would want to come into the office and say, are you certified, you know, up to date, up to speed? Then you decide if you want to go with me or not as a doctor, but you absolutely have the right to ask that question. So with that in mind, here we have this training core in our industry, and somebody becomes the certification arm of our industry that evaluates or tests trainers. Even if they don't pass, they could still be a trainer. If you don't have an ASE master certification, you can still fix cars. Buyer beware.
Yeah, buyer beware. And I would think that would then signify, you could, I'm sure, crunch some numbers and say, okay, the people that did not pass this test, what training did they take? Who gave them the training? Is the training out of date that they took, or is the test that we have written out of date and the training is newer? You know, it goes both ways, in my opinion. Now, obviously, in our industry, ASE does a really good job of updating tests. If somebody was taking the tests and failing the tests, but had taken the training, then I'd have to look at the training and go, okay, why did the training not equate to them passing the test? However, I would ponder to guess that if you took enough training that you would pass the test regardless. I have this feeling, I guess, towards the, like, let's say 10 hours a year, is that enough? Or is 15 hours a year, is that enough? Well, when I start thinking about it of, okay, 14 or 15 hours, let's say, that's taking 2 8-hour classes in a year. Is that enough to keep up with technology in today's automotive industry? It's definitely not. You know, people can try to argue that it is, but stuff changes so fast in 6 months' time in this industry that 2 8-hours worth of classes in a year is not enough to stay up with technology. So could they still pass a test at the end of the year? They definitely could. However, I think if you were taking, let's say, 40 hours or something, I don't know what the number is. We'd all have to get
together. No, you're going to tell me what the number is.
So
what do you think the number is?
I think that a solid week of taking classes, so I'm going with 40.
40?
Yeah.
Minimum.
I would love to see people get 100, but that's 2 to 3 conferences a year, which I get is difficult, especially when you're looking from an educator perspective of their budgets a lot of times don't allow them to spend, you know, that kind of money, which is a whole nother issue in itself. But with 40 hours, I look at it and go, okay, how many, you know, you can take 5 8-hour classes, or you can take 10 4-hour classes. So, you know, at that point, at least you're getting more of what's happening in the industry. And if you're doing that year after year after year, because you're taking more classes, it's much more likely that then you would be able to, A, pass a test, but also it just makes me, I would say, feel better about that. Even if 4 of the 10 classes, let's say they did 10 4-hour classes, even if 4 of those 10 classes sucked, they could still take something away. And the big thing that's made me have this opinion, the why of all this, right? shops will ask me to come in and teach a class for like a 4-hour lunch. This is something that used to happen when I started this business. I don't do it anymore because of this. And then I'd get done, and like a week later they'd go, well, they still don't know what you know. And I'm like, you got to understand, I've been doing hundreds of hours of training for the last 10 years, roughly, is when I really started getting more into it. So, and then also obviously went to college and went to a high school automotive program. So when I started at age 15, then I had 4 years of actual like education, not just learning hands-on, having to learn the book part of it. And then once I got into the field, then learning hands-on from people, but then continuing to go to conferences at hundreds of hours every year. So teaching 1 4-hour class or 2 4-hour classes isn't going to get them that knowledge. And I try to talk to the shops and go, look, they're going to have to go to a whole bunch of these classes. And then I always get the, well, sometimes we've went to a parts store class, it might not have been good. I go, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad. If they go, if they take one single thing from every single class and they take, you know, say they take 30 classes in a year. I don't care if they're hour classes, whatever they are. Say they take 30 classes in a year and they take one thing from all of them. They're significantly further ahead than if they took 1 8-hour class. So it's compounding knowledge.
All I could think about here is the word confession. Bear with me on my little analogy here, because Carm sometimes goes out there. Imagine going to a class. It's been a while since you've been in any kind of education. You went to a Tanner 4-hour, and you walk away, and you say confession to yourself, and that is, wow, I can't believe what I don't know. But you don't say that to anybody. You say it to yourself, to the shop owner that says they don't know what you know. Listen, you've how many hours of training this year have you given them in this particular subject? We can't knock it out in 4. Let's talk to your people. Raise your hand. How many didn't or didn't know on a scale of 1 to 10? We almost need to go out and say, are you learning? What don't you know? What did you know? What do you want to know? There's almost like this whole confession thing of stop hiding behind just because you went to a class. Now you're an expert.
Yeah, agreed. And having that understanding of that, okay, as the shop owner, maybe I didn't do my part in sending them to enough classes. And I always like to just look at the shop owner and go, okay, let's look at the vehicle. Just everything else aside, we have an HVAC system. We have the mechanical portion, and then we have the electronic portion of it. And the electronic portion of it has so many things that it looks at and can turn off the air conditioning system. So they have to know both sides of that. Then we go into body control systems, and we have to understand just the light bulb turn on, turn off of power ground. However, we have logic that says, okay, if amperage is too high or too low, that then we're going to turn those circuits off. So there's just so much. And when I start explaining that, they're like, yeah, I understand now. And I'm like, yeah, because you could take an AC class that goes over nothing but the mechanical portion, and they would still not have any of the knowledge for the electrical. So if they got an electrical AC problem, they wouldn't be able to fix it. So the only way they're going to get that knowledge is to sit through many, many classes. And when you ask a shop owner that and to like confess, you know, have they been going to training? Have they, you know, had this option to do all this? Most of the time, the answer is no, or, well, we don't need all that because we're not going to work on it. And I'm like, the TPMS system, well, we switched a tire on a car. We put one tire on one of these vehicles. It won't work. You can't put one tire on one of these vehicles or two tires on one of these vehicles that looks at resonance, and that'll never work. It'll never go through and calibrate with one single tire. Now all of a sudden you're chasing a problem because you're a tire shop that doesn't do anything else. So the systems are too tied together. You have to get training. And I would, you know, say in most fields, it's like that now, is you have to do training, and you just have to understand that that's part of it.
It's like eating. Okay. Let's just assume if you want to live, you've got to eat. If you want to have a really successful career as a technology specialist, and I lean that way because that's what we're talking about, the brainiac stuff of what we do, you have to train. Okay, we know that. We've been talking about it ad nauseum on my podcast for 9 years, but I have a really interesting question about our youth. You're out in the field, you're leading classes. Are the young people that are coming into our industry curious?
That's a good question. So on two nights ago, I taught a scope class at an advisory meeting, one of the high school advisory meetings I'm on. This is the second or third time I've done it for that school. I do it like each year, it seems. And I would say some of them are. However, we're still struggling from them sending students that are typically the ones that they don't know what to do with. Not that they're bad students or dumb students or anything like that. They're just students that they asked, you know, what do you want to do? And students say, I don't know. Or they're students that don't want to go that extra mile. And I think at this point, they're kind of setting them up for failure when they do that. We also have a big issue with that, like 30 kids start the classes and 2 to 5 will actually finish the class. When those kids get into the automotive industry, are they going to succeed or are they going to struggle knowing they have to keep getting this training? So I'd say the majority of them, unfortunately, that I see are not.
But you're in a bay. You're called in as a mobile diag. You look around, you see that there are some young people there, and I don't know if you let someone, you know, hang out with you, but there are a lot of young people coming in our industry. I'm just hearing about that everywhere. Number one, we have to do this. We have to bring them in. Are you helping someone understand why you did what you did? And if you do, and that there's this young person coming over, yeah, they gave me this job. I don't quite understand it. Thanks for being here, Tanner. Are the younger people working full-time in our industry curious enough to give them a long, fruitful career?
So I always explain to the technician what I did. I would say somewhere around like half are curious. I've got 350 shops. Most of those shops have like somebody that will at least ask a question and go, okay, I want to see it. However, then it comes down to, you know, they're curious, they want to learn. I actually just had this conversation with one of my really good shops yesterday. They may be curious and want to learn. However, are they curious enough to the point where they're going to go to something?
Retain it?
Not so much retain it, but are like, they'll learn from me while I'm there and it's convenient for them, but will they go to a class afterwards? We have a massive problem. Everyone looks at it and goes, you know, oh, there's all these people in Greenville and there's all these people in Asheville. You know, you must be able to do classes there. And we've tried over and over. Greenville never has a good turnout. It didn't when I taught for CTI here. We've done ATG classes here. They don't ever have a good turnout. What it comes down to here is in South Carolina, we value sports and recreation and anything outside of education is what they value more, I guess I would say, which sounds terrible. But when I was scheduling a class, we would schedule a class and I'd go, okay, this is the day we're doing it. Maybe we're doing it once every 6 months. And they'd be like, okay, yeah, I'll come. And then you'd schedule and they'd be like, oh, well, there's a football game that day. There's a Clemson football game. There's a whatever. There was always something better to go do. I'm going hiking. I'm going whatever. And I used to get after the guys and go, look, it is one day. Like, I get you might have to change your plans. You might have something more fun you want to do. However, this is the day that it's offered to you. So take it or leave it. And eventually I got to the point with CTI classes that I just got rid of my region here and said nobody was showing up and it didn't matter what we did. I get asked all the time. Every one of my shops is like, we want training. We want training. And then I try it again and nobody shows up. It's always the same, you know, excuses of, oh, we have this to do or we have this family function. I'm like, there's always going to be something. You have to take the initiative.
When you hold the training at a shop, they've got to show up. It's part of their job. But if you're saying you're going to hold training at one shop and a dozen others are going to send people in, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or at night.
Ben Dexter, National Training Manager for Napa Trax, worked in the field for 25 years. And how'd you deal with training? I says, how'd you get your people to training? And he said to me, I drove them.
Yeah.
I just loved when he said that. And I've been on my soapbox saying, he says, listen, if I ask them to learn it, why shouldn't I, even though I'm not turning wrenches anymore? And I could ask them the curious questions and was that good training? And hey, did we learn enough to make ourselves better and more efficient? So when the boss, the owner, made the commitment not to say you guys go to training and then they don't show up, I get that life is tough and it's complicated today. There's a lot of stuff going on, but you know, who's going? Great. You know, there's four in the shop. Two of them are going. Great. I'm going with you. I'm driving. And meet here at 5 o'clock. We're going.
Yeah. Yep.
Again, I think that part of the training commitment that we have is not to put the responsibility on our technology specialists, our mechanical specialists, but to be there with them, to put your arms around your training commitment and make sure your shop's only going to get better.
Yeah. And then that comes down to then the shop owner, if they're going to do that, either the shop owner's got to be willing, or if it's during the week, they have to be willing to close down the shop, which we know is always a argument of yes or no, this is worth it. You know, we've tried with, obviously, when I worked for Worldpac and stuff, of what times work best during the day, at night, weekends, like nobody agrees on it. So you have to just schedule it and make it.
Here's the argument about I have to close the shop. It's BS in my opinion. Okay. The trend is to do this, to go to the bigger conferences, but I'm going to do my doctor analogy again. When my doctor, Dave, has to go to a conference, I don't know about it. If I call for an appointment, I don't get one on that day or two that he's gone. And, you know, they work around it. You just close because it's important. And you just, you know, ahead of time, a month or two ahead, you just don't book any work on that day.
Exactly. I tell people constantly, you have to schedule in time, not only for training, but then the flip side of this is, you know, making time for life too, of the, if you're like, people ask me all the time with bike riding, how do you make sure that you have time to bike ride? How do you do whatever on the weekends? And I go, I put it in the calendar. I have like Sundays. I put down that at 9 a.m. we're going to go get breakfast somewhere, because that's what we do each Sunday, is we go get breakfast somewhere. So we have to put it in a calendar and say, look, this is what we're doing. And most of the shop management systems now, you can block off days. So if you block off days and you're the owner and go, this is the day we're gone, then nobody can put anything in.
Tanner, yeah. This was a refreshing, I love your outlook on stuff, a refreshing discussion on, you know, how to learn. And I think we covered not only that, but a whole bunch of other really great stuff. So this was this is going to be a classic episode that we want to get people of all areas of our business, of our industry, both shop owners, technicians, service advisors, the whole gamut. Even the suppliers need to listen to this, and maybe you can switch a little bit of your training strategy around the things that Tanner here told us about. Tanner Brandt, Auto Diet Clinic out there in the great state of North Carolina, where they just love to drink beers and climb trees instead of train. I get that. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show, man.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.